Hey, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Equalizer podcast. We are back. The World Cup is bearing down on us, as we've been talking about, and it's very close this time. So we are here to discuss a few things on the World Cup front, some series that we put together on a historical lens. And then we're going to look forward a bit to some predictions of sorts, at least, of some players to watch, some teams to watch on either a surprise or a disappointment level, and look toward 2023. So excited to do that. I'm your host, Jeff Kasouf, and I'm joined today by Blair Newman, who you should hopefully know from EqualizerSoccer.com as an analyst on our front, who's been doing some spectacular work on various levels, the National Women's Soccer League, the Women's World Cup coming up, the U.S. Women's National Team, and excited to talk about some of the things that Blair's been working on, and look forward again to the World Cup. So, Blair, thanks for joining me on this one.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. My Equalizer podcast debut. It's a real pleasure.
Cap number one, just the Savannah DeMello here. First cap as the tune-up to the World Cup, I guess. Well, probably overdue. So, yeah, happy to have you on.
Cheers, Jeff.
Well, look, let's talk. If you're a subscriber to the website, to EqualizerSoccer.com, you'll certainly know Blair's work. You should know the recent series that was put together led by Blair. And that is the Legends of the World Cup, which is an exciting series, really, that we did on Equalizer. If you are not, let me do the housekeeping bit here. EqualizerSoccer.com/subscribe. I'm biased here, but we will give you daily, weekly, you name it. Regular is the word I like to use. Coverage of the NWSL, the U.S. Women's National Team, that you're not going to get anywhere else. And obviously, we will be blanket coverage of sorts at the World Cup. Realistically, that has a U.S. lens, a Canadian lens. I will be down there in New Zealand following the U.S. Harjeet Johal, who has worked for us for roughly a decade at this point, will be in Australia following Canada. So you can expect significant level of Canadian coverage. And then obviously from there, covering and really analyzing, drilling down on some of the big teams, Blair will be part of that coverage. And what's happening? Surely, look, World Cups don't go as planned, right? And Blair and I are going to talk about this here. So if you are not, EqualizerSoccer.com/subscribe. And if you want to put in the code 23, that's just the numerals 23, that'll get you a full year, your first full year for $23, which is well over half off. It's a great deal. And it'll get you everything at the World Cup. All of our season ending NWSL coverage will be at the final. We'll be everywhere and anywhere, and it'll get you into next summer when the Olympics roll around and into next NWSL season. So really pride ourselves on what we do on that front, and it's a deal that you don't want to miss. So EqualizerSoccer.com/subscribe. When you're going to check out there in the annual plan, that is, 23 is the code, and that'll get you a huge discount, $23 for the whole year. So let's, enough of that, I guess. Hopefully you're with us already. If not, you'll join us. The Legends series. I wanted to talk about this, peel back the curtain a little bit, peel back the onion on the process here a bit. I know, these series, Blair, they're fun. I've done a lot of them myself. I've been in position to compile the list, to write the list before of different types of things like this. Inevitably, someone loves it, someone hates it, right? Maybe you come away wondering, wish I could have done this thing. Maybe we could have done this piece. So, if you're looking for it, what I'm talking about here, EqualizerSoccer.com/tag, and then World-Cup-Legends-Series, you'll find it, or you'll just find it, throughout various pieces of our homepage and other deep links that you can find on the website. But we'll put a link in the subscription, the description of this podcast. But Blair, the goal here, I'll let you lay it out. Top 50 legends of the Women's World Cup. What was your starting point? And just walk people through the process here.
So in 2020, when COVID hit, I started to watch a lot of old games because there was no live football. And I noticed that FIFA on their official YouTube channel were doing a lot of old games, and they were doing the full match replays. Since then, I think FIFA Plus has basically uploaded every single World Cup match going back to like 2007 or something. So there's a lot of material out there to get your teeth into if you want to. And I wanted to educate myself more than anything on the history of the game. And to be honest, once I started watching, and the more I watched, the more I wanted to watch, because the quality was, I thought, a lot higher than necessarily I expected. And there's a lot to learn from watching these old games. So I thought going into this World Cup could be quite a good idea. We discussed it, didn't we? The Legend series, and we thought, well, nobody else is really doing this kind of stuff. So let's do it. And I felt comfortable in my knowledge enough to have a good go at it. Along with watching these old games and taking loads and loads of notes, I was reading books and old memorabilia. Your book, The Making of the Women's World Cup, written by yourself and Kieran Tavam, The National Team by Caitlin Murray, Lauren Gregg, former assistant coach to the American national team. She wrote a book in the, I think, the 1990s or early 2000s called The Champion Within, which just has so much really good insight in, women's football, particularly in that era. Evan Pellerud, the former Norway coach, he wrote a book with a guy called Sam Cucci, who called the Coaching and Leadership in Women's Soccer. So I read a lot of books as well, and those bibliographies came in really handy. And through all this, collecting my own notes on games and reading books and memorabilia, old WUSA programs and things that I've got hanging around, that sometimes have little tidbits of information on players. So through all that, I was able to get a good background on the players, their stories. Obviously, through my own analysis, I could figure out what it was they actually brought to the table and what they did. And so that gave me the sort of the actual raw material, the information to work with. Then it was a case of obviously trying to rank the players, and that's when it becomes basically impossible. But I tried to focus first on the quality and the longevity of the players and their performances at World Cups only. So forgetting the Olympics and other competitions. Which is what makes it perhaps a little bit controversial to some, because they see players that are ranked lower than they would maybe expect because they did so well in other tournaments, but it was only World Cups I was looking at. And obviously, first and foremost, went by individual achievements and the legacy that these players left. So, there's some unique players in there. There's players who perhaps other, people who are relatively new to women's soccer aren't so clear on. And so I think that was quite interesting to bring in players like one, Genevieve Annonman, the first African woman to make a Women's World Cup all-star squad. So she has her own unique legacy. And then it was a case of ranking players by position. I did that first, so rank the goalkeepers, rank the centre backs, rank the midfielders, and then from there I did it overall. So there was a process to it. It wasn't necessarily scientific. But then I'm not a very good scientist, so science was never my subject at school. So I think I just tried to do the best I could, and hopefully there's a lot of information on players that readers won't be able to get anywhere else.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, the ranking part is the hard part, right? And in some ways, it maybe can distract from the overall list, maybe, right? And that's it's always a challenge. It's nothing we can control, but the ranking also maybe makes it fun. I don't know if it was fun for you to have to put them in an order, but I know, look, we kicked off the list with two major names, right? Alex Morgan, Christine Sinclair. And, I think maybe people thought, oh, those should be higher. And, I think you explain well there kind of the points you make of all of the different factors and everything involved. And maybe, I don't know, maybe we won't ruin who the exact number one is. I don't think it's necessarily a surprise, right? But, there is this element of, I think one of the hard things too, and this is particularly the case with the US, where I think you were probably mindful, and I think I was as well, and just kind of feedback that I was trying to give you of not having this be too US centric of a list, because they're four-time champions. That's significant history when you only look at eight tournaments back to 91, and it could be easy to make it a very US centric list. Maybe somebody could argue that they feel it is. I don't know, but one hard thing is how do you remove, or maybe I don't know. I'd be curious your thought here because we haven't actually talked about this. So unscripted here, how do you sort of? There's team success, and team success is maybe a product of individual success, right? And 4 years ago, Megan Rapinoe stepping up in such a way, and the U.S. obviously benefiting from that. And in the past, that's Mia Hamm, it's Michelle Akers. How did you find yourself trying to remove those two elements or separate those in some way, not just for the U.S., but for all of these teams?
It's really tricky, isn't it? Because, as you say, there's players. I mean, I think the US could have their own list, and maybe that's one for us for the future. Perhaps a little teaser there for the readers.
I've done those lists with 442. Those are equally difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was tricky, but I think with certain players, you can see even just looking through the archive of awards, you can see these players popping up time and time again, and that gives you some idea of their impact on the tournament. I think with some teams, it's really, really difficult, because I think with the 1991 American team and the 1990, basically the 1990s American team, it's really difficult to leave out anybody from those teams because they were all genuinely exceptional players. You know, most of these players, I think if you took them and basically if we had a time machine, brought them into the modern day, I think they, almost all of them would get into the team today. So sometimes you just have an incredible era, and all of the, or most of these players at least deserve to be included in these sorts of rankings and these conversations. So yeah, it's tricky. I didn't really have a scientific process for it. It was just a case of trying to figure it out and doing it by position. I think ranking the players by positions, and then you can start to sort of see their impact on a position as well. Like Bente Nordby was Norway's goalkeeper for the best part of 15 years, I think, played at numerous World Cups, and she was a world-class goalkeeper. We could say that also about players like Brianna Scurry. We could say it about Nadine Angerer. We could say it about Hope Solo. We could say it about Silke Rottenberg, and on and on. But what defined Nordby for me was not only that she was an important player for a great team, but she almost changed the game in a sense, because she was one of the first sweeper keepers to perform at that level. And Norway, between 91 and 95, moved to a zonal flat back four, and all of a sudden they didn't have a sweeper behind their back line, so their goalkeeper became their sweeper. So Bente Nordby was kind of the first sweeper keeper to play at a World Cup. So again, that kind of impacts her legacy. It's not necessarily in trophies and awards, but tactically she helped to bring the game forward. So it's things like this that can sway things. And obviously there are players who have carried teams more than others. I think if you look at, you mentioned Megan Rapinoe 2019 and her impact, I think you go back to 2015, I think Carly Lloyd towards the end of that tournament really started to grab a hold of it and kind of shape the national team's destiny in a sense, with her sheer force of personality and her performances. So, and we could go on and on, Michelle Akers and Hegarisa and Marta. There's a lot of these players who have kind of shaped tournaments to their will and with their ability. So these players usually rank quite highly in the list because they single-handedly changed tournaments.
Yeah, I love the anecdote you used there of Nordby and why beyond just, hey, here's a great goalkeeper, but factoring in how did this change maybe the sport at large. I think that's awesome. And again, that's littered throughout this list, as you allude to. Any kind of ranking like this, certainly, we could maybe go completely the other way and rely entirely on data. I'm not sure we actually could, though, in a historical list, because of the lack of data around the women's game, even somewhat recently, never mind, the 90s, right? So I'm not sure you could do this as a purely let's make this some kind of a data driven ranking, but there's always some subjectivity. What is the data you're selecting, right? So I think that anecdote is a really great window into how we might put together a list like this, how you went about this particular list. And look, I think if you're listening, if you've read this list, let us know if you agree, disagree, what you liked, what you didn't. Maybe hopefully we've added some insight here, right? And if you haven't, again, go check this out. I think you're going to see names you're familiar with, but maybe names you're not familiar with, maybe names that you know of, but weren't aware of the why and how of their legacy and their impact on the game. So, I think we'll do more things like this. We've done some like this in the past. They're fun. I think they're engaging, and I think it's good to get people talking about these things, especially. And I mentioned this with, again, I was sort of harping on what we do and why you should subscribe. Like, you know, there is a lack of information around the women's game that predates 2017, 2018, right? Especially, I mean, certainly 2015. And like, we've been doing this for 15 years. So, and we have people who've been doing this even longer that we look back and can bring a historic element to some of these conversations that should not be lost in time to a growing sport. So, you know, I think we can add some value there, and hopefully we do. And Blair, maybe before we wrap this piece up, I'm wondering if, you know, what's something that stood out to you, maybe fun or surprising, whether that's a player you didn't think would make this list, or even just something unrelated to a player, maybe something related to the list or the history itself as you kind of went through this process. What's something in this process that maybe, you know, sheds a little insight into to how you went about it?
For sure. I think one thing is just the quality of the players and the teams and the analysis back in the 1990s as well, because in this process, I read books, like I say, by Lauren Gregg and Evan Pellerud and Anson Dorrance as well, who was the head coach of the first World Cup winning American team in 91. And the level of analysis that these coaches were putting in back then is just off the Richter scale. I mean, it really, really was cutting edge stuff. And they were, we talked about data, they were bringing data into the equation as well, and how they could prepare their teams and how they could build their teams. You know, Evan Pellerud, a lot of his players talked about this. You know, he wasn't picking the best Norway team. You know, when they won the World Cup in 1995, it wasn't because they had a bigger population or more registered female players than the Americans or the Germans. It was because he put the pieces in place, and he wasn't necessarily picking the best players. The striker, Linda Madolin, said that. She said he was just putting a team together, and it worked really, really well. And if you look at Norway's history, I think it's clear to see that what was happening under Evan Pellerud worked very, very well. And you know, since then, they haven't really had as much success. They actually, when he came back, they made a Euro final again, and then they kind of drifted away again. So, you know, I think the quality of the players and the quality of the coaching and the analysis back in the, you know, in the 1990s when the World Cup was first, it first began, was really, really good. And, you know, certainly deserves to be given attention, I think, by modern analysts when they're, you know, trying to understand the game as it is today. Always helps to go back and see, you know, where it came from. I think the other thing, I mean, I just want to mention a team really, which is China in the 1990s, because, I mean, as far as I was aware before I did the research for this and watched all these games, Japan were the team that brought a sort of short passing game to the fore in the women's international scene. But going back and watching China, they were doing that kind of 10, 15 years before Japan did it. And the level of fluidity and technical quality that Chinese team had, and some of these players, you know, Liu Eiling, Wang Liping, they're not necessarily big names anymore. And you won't necessarily hear people talk about them when they talk about China. It's usually Sun Wen. And she was obviously a sensational player as well. And the first, you know, she was a false, Sun Wen was a false nine before that terminology even was around. You know, people talk about false nine strikers that play in midfield more nowadays. Sun Wen was doing that back in 1995. So a lot of the ideas that we think are new aren't new. You know, the players and the teams back then were, I think, as good, if not better in some cases, than what we see today. And yeah, some of these ideas that we think of as new, whether it's a short passing game or whatever, they were being done back then. And so it was a really nice surprise to go back and watch and see this with my own eyes.
Awesome stuff. Really good insight there. Could continue to talk about this, but maybe first go ahead, read that Legends series, top 50 legends of the Women's World Cup. We count them down 50 through one on equalizersoccer.com. You can find that in various places there. And we'll try to make it as obvious as possible. And we'll put that link in the show description of this podcast. We'll be right back. Blair and I talking about the World Cup that's upon us in just a few days at this point, I could say. And we'll preview that coming up after the break. All right, back here with the Equalizer Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Kasouf, and I'm here with Blair Newman. We're talking about the 2023 World Cup coming up. Before we do that, please go ahead, rate, review, subscribe to this podcast. Helps us with visibility, helps us get the word out. And that's something that we need to do. So that helps us. We appreciate all the positive reviews. And we look forward to bringing you more content and analysis like this. So I want to dive into this. I will tie it back slightly to an article that you have and maybe prompt you to, I don't know, pick one of your list or maybe even someone from outside the list. Blair, I thought we could do some superlatives of sort of the 2023 World Cup. And I wanted to start with the players, because I think obviously the players make the World Cup. They make us, you know, they are the memories that we have. We just talked about players and counting them down. We remember teams, certainly, but we remember some individual performances. And whether that's a player carrying her team to a title, or it's a breakout player that, you know, gets discovered on the world stage. So this past week, you wrote 8 prospects to watch, and they're sort of maybe off the beaten path. I'm wondering if you'd want to pick one of those, or even someone who's maybe outside of that list that is maybe you think could be a breakout, in the sense of here's someone not being talked about who could win the golden ball, the golden boot. Who's a surprise player to watch? And I'll let you classify which level of surprise that could be. Who's a surprise player to watch maybe at this World Cup?
I think from the list I did, like you say, I was trying to steer clear of big names that maybe the readers have already seen and know all about. Probably Clara Kinney Cross is one of those players who I think people who are really into the women's soccer and maybe watched a bit of the Australian League, a bit of the Swedish League, or just a bit of the Australian national team, they will know about Kinney Cross. But I think she's one of those players, like you say, who could go from being a very, very clearly a talented young player to a star of the tournament, because she's at the heart of things for Australia. They're a counter-attacking team. They've got a lot of pace up front. Another player to watch out for is Courtney Vine, who's just electrically quick. But Kinney Cross is the sort of playmaker in midfield. And I think she's only 20 years old. She's been playing in Sweden with Hammarby. And yeah, she's just very, very good on the ball. Great passer, great crosser. She can take a mean corner kick. And I think with Australia particularly, because they're a counter-attacking team and they do rely a lot on, let's get the ball to Sam Kerr. It's sort of like watching, you know, the Chicago Red Stars from a few years ago, and, you know, to an extent Chelsea nowadays. It's, you know, win the ball, get it to Sam Kerr, run her in behind, she can score. But when Australia comes up against a team that gives them a low block, defends against them, they're going to need to break them down. So that's the sort of game where I think Clara Kinney Cross could be a game changer for Australia. The other player I think I'm really looking forward to watching is Melchie de Mornay. And again, not necessarily a new name. I think we both watched her play at the CONCACAF tournament last year, didn't we, the World Cup qualifiers, and she gave the USA a hard time. And I've seen her play in France the last couple of years. Last season, she took it to another level, and she has been signed by Lyon. That deal was concluded well before the end of the season. So Lyon are going to sign her from Stade de Reims, where she's been playing. And I think essentially she's been brought in to replace Caterina Macario, who obviously is now off to Chelsea. So de Mornay is an outrageously talented young player. You know, technically, you know, her control is just so tight. The ball is that old kind of cliche of being glued to her foot. And, you know, she can turn either way. She can create. She can score. She has a good change of pace. So I don't know if Haiti are going to get any results at this World Cup, but if they are going to get anything against England, Denmark and China, I think de Mornay will be at the heart and soul of it.
Yeah, I really like that shout. I agree. De Mornay is supremely talented. I was going to say, I think, you know, brought in with an eye toward Macario possibly leaving, as she did for Chelsea. And, you know, I think this is a good point too for, this is, you know, again, sort of pulling back the curtain a little bit. On what we do, like, you know, if you're listening and you're a regular Equalizer listener, reader, you know, the World Cup is an interesting spot for us because it's a balance of, you know, maybe to the hardcore fan, de Mornay is potentially a relatively obvious candidate to say, okay, this could be a breakout player. But the reality of a World Cup is, you know, we're around, right? We know how many people are in the stands for an NWSL game, for, you know, how many are watching these games. It's it's growing, it's decent, but we're talking in the numbers of tens of thousands, maybe viewership in the hundreds of thousands. A World Cup, you know, we'll see. They're expecting to count the number of viewers in the billions as they finally cracked in 2019, right? So, you know, we have to remember that as much as Melchi de Mornay seems like, okay, that's a name we've been tossing around in these circles, 95% of the people who turn on this World Cup will have never heard of her, will not know anything about Haiti, and will be surprised probably by the level of quality on that team, which I agree, I think is good. Is it get out of the group? Is it get results in the group good? We'll see. I mean, I think, you know, these World Cups, they're about matchups. They're about timing. I don't totally write them off. I mean, you know, are they going to get a result against England? Maybe they give them trouble and don't end up getting any points. You know, can they get one against Denmark or China? As you said, they gave the U.S. trouble. I mean, the U.S. was on the ropes for a bit in that qualifying game, right? I mean, bottom line, De Mornay torches Becky Sauerbrunn and the rest of the defense, but that specific play early on.
Did they not miss a penalty as well, Jeff?
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, they've got quality beyond her, obviously. But yeah, I think that's a good shout. You know, probably one where, to your point, I mean, this could go either way, right? I mean, maybe it's a breakout player who, you know, this is a tournament where she's already made that big signing, right? She's made the jump to Lyon. So she's not necessarily the candidate for, okay, some big club suddenly notices. But the World Cup is where clubs start seeing, you know, something come to fruition for a player that they thought had potential, and they see it against the best opponents in the world. But I think where a player like her gets discovered by the wider world and for good reason. So I like that shout. And I think to your point about Australia, which, I mean, we'll see who's, I don't know if this is your pick, but who is a team that you think might surprise for the better in terms of, let's say, I'm interested in this. I think we love the term dark horse. I don't love the term. I think it's overused in some regard and, you know, almost used in a silly manner when we start calling like top 10 teams dark horses, right? But who's a team that could surprise, whether that is make some upsets in the group stage and get out of the group, or, you know, right down to the end, if you think there's a team that could be a quote unquote surprise winner, who do you think's a team to watch out for at this World Cup?
Well, I don't know if Australia would be a surprise winner because they're the co-host nation. I suppose, and, you know, if we look at the history, Jeff, of World Cup hosts, like apart from the USA, host nations have traditionally done terribly, terribly poorly. So, you know, even Germany went out of quarterfinals in 2011. So usually it's the quarterfinals that teams fall out. So, I mean, maybe Australia could be classified as a surprise if they go all the way.
I think that would be a surprise, personally.
Yeah, I think it would be, wouldn't it? So I'd probably have Australia as a potential surprise team to win the whole thing. Other than Australia, I think you're looking at teams getting out of the group. I think Philippines, you know, I watched them play Scotland and Wales in the Pinatar tournament, the friendly tournament earlier this year, and I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised by how organised they are. Just a really stuffy team to break down. And you put them in a group with New Zealand and Switzerland and even a Norway team that, let's face it, last year beaten 8-0 by England, went out of the Euro group stage. I mean, I know they're now managed by a legend in Hege Riise, but she was a legend as a player, not as a manager. So that is definitely an open group. And I could see the Philippines getting a couple of results there. I really could. I could see them beating New Zealand. I could see them getting a result even against Switzerland. So I certainly wouldn't write them off. And the other team, Jeff, I'd like to mention is Republic of Ireland, because obviously we both saw them play against the United States in that warm-up friendly. You know, they're a solid team, and they have a lot of big centre-backs. They defend with a back five. They've got the set-piece delivery of Katie McCabe. I don't know if they're going to be the most entertaining team to watch in the world, but I think for a team like Canada trying to break down the Republic of Ireland, that could get interesting, I think. And I think Ireland could potentially get out of Group B as well. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, good shouts. I would say, look, everything, I wanted to say this farther up front, but I wanted to say everything we say here is relative, right? There's no, we'll get into some pathways in the knockout stage here too and whatnot. There's no such thing as an easy way to win a World Cup or anything, but everything's relative. And I say that prompting this, Group A is weak. I mean, you know, and that's by way of New Zealand. To your point about hosts, New Zealand has not won a World Cup game, despite being a perennial perennial team in appearances in World Cups. So the idea of a host nation having the goal of simply winning a game and getting out of the group, which we've seen at times, you know, very rarely, I would say. We saw it, you know, that was, I think, externally, maybe realistic on the men's side with Qatar. This was a conversation around South Africa in 2010, right? But, you know, this is, you know, to have New Zealand as a seeded team, and then, as you say, Norway, Switzerland, Philippines, I mean, that is an open group. Yes, Norway, I think if you were to look at individuals with quality and some individuals that I'm really high on, that we're, you know, I think we're all really high on in Hegerberg, Wrighton, you know, obviously Carolyn Grant-Hampson, you know, I think that there are, you know, team, there are individuals there, but it's an overall a weak group. So I think those are good shouts. We talked about Haiti and, you know, again, back to individuals, you know, again, is this going to happen? I don't know, but I look at Group C and what is the effect of everything off the field on Spain, on the field? Has Japan really figured it out in sort of this strange cycle that they've really, two cycles, I guess you could say, that they've been in? And then Costa Rica, are they really going to challenge? So then I look at Zambia and say, okay, Barbara Banda's on that roster, which a year ago was unclear. We saw what she could do in the Olympics. Singularly, she's not the only talent there. You've written about this. I think people probably, again, 95% of people coming to this tournament not knowing anything and looking maybe even with a predisposition for what are these men's teams like, and, oh, okay, Spain can do this. And, you know, even like coming maybe with the idea of that with an Italy or Argentina in another group. But I think they probably look and say, oh, Zambia, you know, they know nothing about them and they write them off. I think Zambia is a team just on individual talent there alone that could carry a team.
Yeah.
That could make some noise here. So I'm interested in how Group C plays out.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that, Jeff, because Zambia is a great shout, actually, for me. And I think that when you throw them in the Group C with Spain and Japan as well, Spain and Japan, both teams who are sort of in a transition period at the moment, and also both teams who, I think, watching them, they always have a lot of possession, but they don't really have a cutting edge. So you put them in against a Zambia team who, their weaknesses are defensive, but if you give them any opportunities, they're probably going to take them because they've got Banda, they've got Kundanji, who's just scored double figures for Madrid in the Spanish league. They've got Chanda, who plays with her for Madrid. I mean, Zambia can score against anybody in this tournament, I think. So if Spain and Japan aren't decisive against Zambia, maybe they could drop points.
Yeah, yeah. Interested to see there. Let's talk about potential disappointments, because there's plenty of teams I think you could designate as favorites. There's you know, your obvious sort of top 10, of which I think really classifies probably true contenders, if you would even extend it to 10 maybe. But disappointments, who might that be? And maybe the brief version of where do you see them flaming out to call it a disappointment?
You touched on New Zealand there a bit, Jeff, and I have to say I'm gearing up to be heartbroken for New Zealand this summer, because I'd like them to do well. I always want the host nations to do well, because I think it keeps the atmosphere going in games. And I don't know, it always feels a bit more fun when the host nations are still in the competition. But I've watched them, I don't think they've won a game for like 9 or 10 games in friendlies. And it's not like they're playing, you know, elite opposition every single time. I don't really understand what it is that they're trying to do. Jitka Klimkova, the manager, has a track record in Europe. You know, but I don't really understand how they're playing. Are they a high press team? Are they a low block team or something in between? The players don't seem to be bought into what they're being asked to do, what they're trying to do. That's not an indictment on the manager. It's just what I'm observing, watching them. That's the way it seems to me, because they're not short on talent, New Zealand. They have some good players. They've got players playing in the A-League in Australia. You know, they've got some players dotted around Europe, even in England and in America as well. It's a decent team and they're on home soil. So you'd like to think they can get out of the group and get that first World Cup when you mentioned. But I've seen them defend and they're conceding goals just from simple crosses into the box. And I just have a really horrible feeling, you know, Norway, Switzerland, even the Philippines. I mean, it would not shock me if they lost every single game. So I'm preparing to be disappointed by New Zealand. Hopefully they will surprise me. The other team I think people are starting to maybe ask questions of his England as well. And they obviously won the Euros last year, and it's kind of a bit of a deja vu because I don't know if you remember the lead up to the Euros last year that I wrote a piece on England and I was sort of asking questions about them then. It's not this similar feeling now, but they've got a lot of injuries. They've lost their captain, Leah Williamson. Your Beth Mead, who is so important at last year's Euro, is out. The entire front four basically has changed. Alan White has retired. Mead is out injured. Fran Kirby is injured. So three of the four will not have been starters at last year's Euros. We saw them fail to break down Portugal in a recent friendly, 0-0 draw. Portugal, very decent team, not to be underestimated, but disappointing performance from England, and that's happened in a few other friendlies too. So I think certainly talent-wise there's no shortage, but I think they're struggling to find the right dynamic, particularly in their attack, with a lot of new young players who are really gifted but maybe don't quite understand how they work together yet. There's that question mark over Rachel Daly, who was the left back at last year's Euros. Now she's possibly going to lead the line. We all thought that was going to be Alessia Russo, but probably isn't going to be now. So there's a lot of question marks about England going into this tournament and some poor form. And then you throw them into the toughest side of the draw, I think. And they could meet Canada in the second round, potentially. I don't think there's any guarantees they beat Canada on current form. And the idea of England maybe going out second round or, let's say, in a quarter final against Germany, I think that would be hugely disappointing for a team that won the Euros last year. So they're probably another team I'll throw into the mix.
A good shout, and one to watch. I mean, look, like the US here, I think you could qualify disappointment for England as anything but winning, right? So, that's going to be the US, and I think this will bleed into my last question that I wanted to quickly touch on with you is who we think might win it, and I guess maybe I don't know how you feel. I'm always a bit hesitant on the prediction front in that it's often sort of. It's a nice sort of tweet that didn't age well type of deal, right? Somebody likes to reference, oh, you picked this one, and obviously you've got to have your reasoning. If your reasoning is sound, I mean, look, I think the U.S. to touch on them briefly, which we haven't really here, just to say, I think it's a team that could win it. I think it's also a team that could go out quite early in terms of relative to their success, having never finished below third, but. Part of the reason that they could win it is not just that they do have talent, but that they're on a nice side of the bracket. And again, all things relative. They've got a lot of teams that I think would give them more trouble. Not all of them, but more trouble. More concentrated group is on the other side of the bracket. And I think tying this back and forward, I guess, before I ask you who you think, I think Australia could be a disappointment in that it's a host nation with high expectations that maybe are unrealistic. If those expectations are let's win this thing on home soil, I think that's a very tall order for them specifically. And tying that to a team that I really like, again, I don't know if I'm, maybe I'm couching this and not saying I'm not picking Brazil to win this whole thing, but I'm very interested in Brazil in that we often gravitate toward European teams. You mentioned England winning Euro. I think that'll bring, sort of general attention. The US always has the attention. Brazil is a team that is in a post-Marta era, at least this being her last World Cup, maybe coming off the bench. Pia Sundhage is in charge, managing that, bringing a sort of, again, things that you're gearing up to write and have been writing about, of bringing sort of a defensive mentality, some Swedish-American isms to Brazil, where you balance out that flair. Really interested in them. If they win Group F, if Australia wins Group B, they progress. There's a quarterfinal matchup. Who do you like in that? I mean, I like Brazil there, even if it is on Australian soil. So I'm really interested to see Brazil. I think it'd be a cool moment, obviously from the Marta element, but even for a team that's come so close many times before, has kind of ebbed and flowed in form and prowess of recent cycles. And I think that could be a pretty amazing story to the degree, I don't want to tie things too much to the men's game, but seeing Argentina win it, being led by Messi, right? I mean, I think that there are some, and this has been written about already and talked about, there are some parallels there with Brazil coming up short so many times of late, and having Marta in this swan song of a World Cup. I think the talent is there. I think Pia Sundhage has done a pretty good job putting it together. Does it all come together in the right way? We'll see. But that's the one for me to watch in terms of potential winners and maybe even outside the slightly obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brazil is a great shout, Jeff. You know, them and Australia are the two teams that intrigue me. As you said, that they're on a collision course. If they both win their groups, win their second round matches, then they will meet in the quarterfinals. And that, as much as I love watching Australia play and counterattack, that has real USA France 2019 vibes to me, where, you know, the host nation puts up a good fight, gets people going, but ultimately loses in a close match. And the thing I like about Brazil, as you say, Sundhage, she came in, if we rewind 4 years, Brazil were defensively a little bit of a mess. They weren't really very well structured. If we look at them today, it's a completely different situation. And it hasn't worked in every single friendly, but I do think Sundhage has been quite experimental as well in some of these matches. She's even played Caroline, who we all know at North Carolina is a winger or a forward. She's played her in central midfield in some of these games. She's played Adriana in central midfield in some of these games. So she has really tried to experiment with her players, see what they're capable of before the tournament, which is, I think, the right thing to do. Then you go into the tournament and you've got a clear idea of what you don't want to do. I like them a lot. And one of the reasons I like them is I think, firstly, they can counterattack with Caroline, with Adriana, with Dabinia. I think that's a really scary proposition for any defence. If you lose the ball and they start running at you and you're not really set to defend against them, I think it's curtains. And the other thing is they could defend their box, I think, for 90 minutes. You know, Rafaela, who's just made the move to Orlando, she was really, really good for Arsenal in WSL, a classy player, left-footed centre-back, but also a solid centre-back. You've got Cathalén with Real Madrid, who has always been a pretty strong stopper. And then you've got Lauren, who was in my list of potential breakout players, who isn't a starter at the moment. But when Brazil threw out a back five in the Finalissima with England recently, Lauren was starting in that with Cathalén and Rafael, and England did not have a nice time against that back three. So I think Brazil combining that defence and Pia Sundhage's know-how, and then you throw in their counter-attacking threat, which is up there with anybody, they definitely can win this World Cup, I think. And probably right now, they are actually my favourites to win the whole thing. And again, it's one of those predictions which could look completely stupid. 2 games into the tournament, they lose to France. I don't know, maybe they struggle against Jamaica. Bunny Shaw gets a few, I don't know. So we'll see. But I do think Brazil can win the tournament. And besides that, I think probably Germany are looking quite good to me, because I think the thing with Germany before last year's Euros was Martina Voss-Tecklenburg was the head coach, and everybody seems to buy into her as a coach, and there seems to be a good harmony within that group. But she always had a real dilemma with her midfield. She never really seemed to know who to pick in midfield. And if we look at the 2019 World Cup, they lost to Sweden in that quarterfinal. That was a shock defeat. And they were playing Alexandra Popp at the base of midfield. Basically, it was just an attacking midfield. There was no holding players in there, no balance in there. Now they've got Lena Oberdorf. They've got someone like Lena Latwine. They've got Sydney Lohmann. Not all of these are pure defensive players, but they've got a lot of power in there to win the ball and to put pressure on the opponent. And I think, Germany, definitely not a surprise, but they could be contenders as well.
Well, we'll see how things play out at this World Cup. We'll see how accurate or not we are in our high praise of Brazil. I guess mixed feelings on Australia to some degree. And then if any of these surprise teams that get out of the group, I think that'll be those are really, you know, they're not necessarily teams that, are, you know, the Philippines are not going to go win the World Cup. Right. I'm not breaking any news here. But, you know, I think those are the really unique and cool stories. I mean, I think. Beyond the obvious stuff, which is the knockout rounds and the big teams, I'm thinking of 2019 off the cuff and thinking about the Scotland Argentina game. Maybe for some negative reasons, for some controversial reasons, but you know, neither of those teams. I don't think neutrals had that game circled on the calendar. Right? Is no. What I'm getting at. And you know, ultimately, those are some really interesting games. And if those teams can pull off those types of teams can pull off upsets and maybe get out of the group. I think those are, you know, to some degree what the stories of the World Cup are all about at a team level. And then obviously we talked about players. So we ran a bit long here, but I'm looking forward to, you know, to the World Cup coming up. Like I said, I'll be down there. Harjeet will be down there for Equalizer with covering Canada. We'll be very far apart, actually, but such is the nature of this World Cup that's co-hosted, and we'll have plenty of coverage on it, and we'll keep plugging away here on the podcast as well. So keep listening, and Blair, appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. As always, thank you to our producer, Jacqueline Purdy, and we'll see you again next time soon on the Equalizer podcast.